From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The recession may be over, we're told, but the current picture of the U.S. economy still isn't pretty. Job gains are weak, so is the stock market. Home foreclosures are up, even with low mortgage rates and 0% financing on everything from cars to washing machines. What comes out in the wash is one sluggish economy. President Bush today put in his two cents about the sputtering economy, speaking in Davenport, Iowa. He appealed to the Senate for fiscal restraint as it heads toward a September 20th deadline to finish spending legislation.
For the sake of fiscal sanity, the United States Senate must remember whose money we're spending and get us a budget, and get us to head toward a balanced budget.
While the president wants lawmakers to march toward a balanced budget, he's also marching toward war with Iraq. And the economic consequences of that military action are uncertain. In this hour, the search for America's economic recovery and a question, does war help or hurt? Are you personally feeling an economic recovery or still waiting? Do you see signs of a comeback? And what will fuel the country's next economic surge? Joining me tonight from Washington, D.C. is Christian Weller. He's a macroeconomist at the Economic Policy Institute. Good evening and welcome, Christian Weller.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Thanks very much for being with us. You watch this every day. A lot of us check in and out in the last few weeks as Iraq and the anniversary of 9/11 have taken over our screens and our speakers and our newspapers. Maybe we've lost track. Where is the U.S. economy right now? Are we still in recession? Are we really out of recession?
Well, I think there's two different pictures. We're in a situation that I would call a holding pattern. We're slowly growing, probably at an order of magnitude 1 to 2% a year. That's output growth. However, if output grows less than 3%, let's say this is a rule of thumb, then unemployment is likely to rise, or employment is actually going to be relatively stagnant as it is. So we are out of a recession when it comes to just what we call the gross domestic product, or
the formal definition of a recession.
Yeah, that's kind of, well, not really. I mean, because the labor market does play into the calculation of the National Bureau of Economic Research. And the labor market is, I think, still in a recession. We are likely to see further increases in the unemployment rate in the near future, meaning for the rest of this year, early next year, because output is going to continue to grow less than 3%.
So you see a holding pattern, and a holding pattern at a level so modest that it doesn't feel like recovery. And in fact, in comparison to the boom that everyone remembers in the 90s, it still feels lousy.
It does feel lousy, and probably for many people it is lousy. This is not just a subjective feeling. I mean, we have seen a rapid increase in the unemployment rate. We have very, very low employment growth, probably a third of what it used to be. And we have very slow wage growth. And the other picture that's also beginning to emerge now is that rising healthcare costs are eating into the very meager increases in paychecks that people are seeing. So the situation for people who have jobs is pretty poor, and the situation for people who are still out of jobs is also not particularly good.
So here we are, holding pattern at a level that no one really likes, coming off of a great boom and then bust. And now a war. How is a war likely to factor in here? We heard Lawrence Lindsay say over the weekend and again today that he's thinking it could cost $100 billion, $200 billion. But this is the White House economic advisor who dismissed the economic consequences of the likely spending on a war, saying this is not going to sink the ship. It's not going to dent whatever recovery is there. What's your view, Christian Weller?
Well, I think it's very hard to predict what another war with Iraq will mean, in particular since nobody has particularly well defined what a war with Iraq would look like. Now, let's take Lawrence Lindsay's number, $100 to $200 billion. Now, that's a pretty large range, $100 to $200 billion. It's probably not unrealistic that a short-term war, just like it was in the early 1990s, would probably cost in that range. However, that doesn't mean that that money is a U.S. money. It may be very well money that the Allies paid, just like they did in the early 1990s, or the other way around. This time around, the U.S. may foot the bill almost entirely by themselves. Simply because there's a strong dollar, it is very easy for the U.S. to pay for this war, relatively speaking.
But the president's man looked out at this and he said, 1 year, $100-200 billion out of a federal debt of $3.6 trillion. He said, quote, that's nothing.
It is. Well, I wouldn't say it's nothing. I mean, it's still 1-2% of gross domestic product if the money would all be spent in the United States.
But does it pump up the economy? Does it somehow bring down the economy? Or is it small enough in the grand scheme of the economy that it doesn't make a difference?
I think there is there is a chance that it may be small enough that it can just be shrugged off as a blip, but I think there are serious risks here. In particular, there is the major risk that a war with Iraq will lead to long-term inflation increases.
Now, why might that come out? People are talking about inflation today. Why might this war or any war perk up inflation?
Well, I mean, the experience with Afghanistan has shown us a war that we thought was very simple. We go in, bomb whatever, some caves, and we go out again and the thing is over, can actually drag on for quite some time. And a war with Iraq could drag on for quite some time, thereby boosting oil prices over a year or two or even longer, and that could lead to increases in oil prices.
So you're saying that higher oil prices could then also spark inflation in the United States?
That is one worry. The other worry is the United States is in quite a much more precarious situation than we were in the early 1990s. Right now, we have a trade deficit that is relative to gross domestic product about twice as big as the one that we had in the early 1990s. That means that we need to finance this trade deficit by attracting foreign capital here. However, if we engage in a war in the Middle East, foreign investors may very well stay away from the United States and go somewhere else. That means we may have to raise interest rates or may do something else that would hurt the economy to attract that foreign capital here. I think that there are enormous risks associated with the war that go beyond just spending $100 billion or $200 billion.
Enormous risks associated with the war. You mean that it would expand, that it would be long-lived, that the nation building afterward would be costly, that kind of thing?
That is correct. I mean, it could be costly. It could be costly for us. It could cost a lot more. It could go a lot longer, cause inflation in the United States, force overseas investors to shun the United States.
I wonder about that point. You just raised it, Christian Weller, but historically in times of instability, even crisis, the United States has been a haven for capital from around the world. Why do you think that this time that would be different? Last week, the president stood up at the UN, made a strong speech, and everyone was saying, hup to, off we go. Isn't the United States still the kind of best guarantor, even if not perfect?
Well, I think the situation has changed. The first thing is our overall economic stability is somewhat more shaky than it was a few years ago. In particular, as an economy, we're still borrowing money from overseas at a record rate. Our households are mired in debt. Our companies are mired in debt. That really doesn't bode well for stability. The other part is there is now a major competitor to the dollar. In particular, the euro is finally completely introduced in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It is a major competitor to the U.S. currency. So, and European growth rate are predicted to be slightly higher in the near future than U.S. growth rates. So if I was an investor at this point, I would probably put my money into Europe.
We're talking tonight with Christian Weller. He's a macroeconomist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., about economic recovery and war. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Are we coming out of the woods yet economically? Is your personal recession over yet? You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined now from Hanover, New Hampshire, by On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. Good evening and welcome, Jack Beatty.
Hello, Tom.
Good to have you with us. I think you've been listening to the conversation we've been having with Christian Weller. Jack, what's your sense from where you sit? We're technically moving out of recession. Does it feel like it?
Well, it's hard to know. I see in the Financial Times today, they had an editorial about the high-tech industry, and they say that the downturn in that industry, which has been a sort of elixir to the whole economy, looks cyclical. Now they're saying it looks structural. That is to say that the problems of that industry go beyond anything like a dip in the economy, that there's just so much overcapacity there that there's going to continue to be shakeouts in that industry. And in general, any discussion of our economy today, you know, has to take into account the looming crisis of overcapacity pretty much up and down the line. Some people think, the economic historian Robert Brenner, in a recent book, argues that this is the lurking sort of poison in the cup for the world economy, that there just is so much overcapacity in manufacturing especially, that eventually this itself is going to lead to problems. It's going to lead to contraction of manufacturing jobs. It's going to lead to the social disruption that occasioned by that. And to the fall in demand that might bring about. Some people even compare the manufacturing worker today, at least in labor-intensive manufacturing, to the farmer around 1900. You know, there were about 60% of the people were farmers then, and now there are 3% who are farmers. If the productivity revolution hits manufacturing as it hit agriculture, we could see massive changes of which the issues of recovery and so on would be sort of, blips in this long-term trend.
Christian Willer, what about that? I think that Jack's putting his finger on the fear behind the daily newspaper reading that we all do, that somehow this may be more than an ordinary recession, that we're up against some fundamental flaw or something fundamentally out of whack. Maybe it's overcapacity. Maybe there's too much capacity to pump goods out globally. Are we just in another cycle and we should not panic about it? We're going to be fine. Or is there something different going on this time in the recession that we're trying to nose out of and the greater framework around it?
It's hard to say, but I do think that there is something slightly different about this recession or this downturn than about previous ones. First, I think this one is much more global than previous ones. Really, the major economic blocks like the U.S., Europe, and Japan really moving in sync. When we went in a downturn, so did Europe, and Japan basically never recovered.
So we're all down together at this point.
Yes, and really there is, so somebody has to drag us out of it, and as Jack was just pointing out, there is a lot of overcapacity. I mean, the steel industry is the prime example. In the U.S., it's particularly commercial construction has a lot of overcapacity. There's a lot of overcapacity. Now, the flip side to overcapacity is that there isn't enough demand. So if we have two problems. We have two solutions. We can either destroy a lot of capacity, which doesn't make that much sense, mm-hmm. or we can try to build up demand. And I think that really has to be the focus for economic policy.
Well, we've certainly got a big population globally and lots of people who need housing and food and everything else that ought to be a basis for demand, shouldn't it?
There is a lot of needs, not only globally, but also domestically. I mean, there are a lot of needs that we need to address. Housing, our schools, many schools are dilapidated. I think there is a lot of needs that can be addressed. It's just a question who can do it. And at this point, it seems that the government, the federal government in particular, is the only source of new demand growth.
You mean when they pump up new federal programs or whatever it may be, school building or missile building?
I would at this point, because we're really speaking about an economic stimulus that would have to come very quickly and that would have to be temporary. I wouldn't necessarily argue for new programs rather than building up existing programs or funding existing programs either by improving unemployment insurance, or another example would be improving school repairs. And that is a means of getting money very quickly into the economy. But let me also add, we're not in this alone. I mean, we're really, as I said, this is a global recession.
But that's hardly comforting. That means there's no other engine to pull us out.
That is correct. But I think it also forces us to A, realize this, and B, engage in a conversation with our counterparts, and particularly in Europe, about a global stimulus package, meaning the U.S. will spend more money, but also the Europeans. And I understand that the Italians and the French government are already talking about ignoring the Maastricht requirements, running larger deficits than the Maastricht requirements would allow them to spend more money in their own economies.
But we heard President Bush at the top of the hour talking about fiscal restraint when he spoke today in Davenport, Iowa. Christian Willer, please stand by. We've got to take a short break. Listeners, are you feeling an economic recovery or still the slowdown? Does war look helpful or harmful economically to you? And what's the level of your consumer confidence in the autumn of 2002? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Talking about economic recovery and war, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the state of the U.S. economy. Here's President Bush again from earlier today.
One of the ways we got to make sure that we keep our economy strong is to be wise about how we spend our money. If you overspend, it creates a fundamental weakness in the foundation of economic growth.
President Bush speaking today in Davenport, Iowa. We're talking about economic recovery and war. Is your business, your company, getting back in gear? And what do you expect the next robust American economy to look like? If it won't be 80s style or 90s style, what will it be? What's it going to take to get the country back on track economically? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. We're joined tonight by Christian Weller. He's a macroeconomist at the Economic Policy Institute, and by our own news analyst, Jack Beatty. And by you, Dennis is on the line. Welcome, Dennis. You're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
You posed the question about, you know, how are we all feeling about our own personal recovery? And
yes.
I have to say, as I've listened to the news reports over the last few months of this supposed recovery, I have to say, you know, pull an old jingle from the 70s, where's the beef? I don't buy it. I actually, my personal feeling is it's somewhat of a Pygmalion effect going on.
What do you mean by that, Dennis?
Well, I mean that we all know that one of the prime drivers of our economy is a consumer confidence.
Mm-hmm.
And if consumer confidence is low, what's really going to drive the economy? So it's in our best interest to sort of keep consumer confidence high so that people feel good, will spend money, will feel safe about spending money. I myself sold a piece of property in Boston almost over a year ago now.
All right.
With the intent of buying another house. That money is all sitting in a money market, I'm afraid to say, because A, I'm afraid to invest it anywhere, and B, I question my own job security.
So you're on the sidelines. You're not confident enough even to invest the chunk of cash that you got out of a property you sold.
No, exactly. And my partner has been out of work for over a year now. And I have lots of friends who have been out of work for that long or longer who were part of the dot-com bust or part of the high-tech bust.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's definitely been a fundamental restructuring in that whole industry, as one of your guests alluded to earlier,
There's no question about that. Dennis, thanks for bringing us your perspective. And Jack Beatty, here's the consumer voice of the consumer who's really on the sidelines, not willing to even invest the money, not willing to let it go anywhere because he's not confident of his job and not confident that the market is going to give him any return.
Yeah, look how the things are interconnected. He's worried about his job, so he won't mobilize that money. If he doesn't mobilize that money, the economy doesn't get the effect of it, and it's not earning very much money for him. I mean, John Maynard Keynes said that, you know, booms are built on animal spirits, that people just invest out of almost a kind of surge of primitive feeling, hope in the future, and so on. Well, he also said that busts are fueled by just such feelings as this, a kind of timorousness, a sort of fundamental lack of confidence, a retreat from risk. You multiply this, Dennis's story by the millions, and you've got the key actor in this play, the consumer, would seem to be stepping back.
Jack Beatty, Christian Weller, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation David Leonhardt. He's an economics reporter for the New York Times. Good evening and welcome, David Leonhardt.
Thanks. It's good to be on.
Good to have you. David Leonhardt, we've just been hearing from a listener saying, you know, I am so gun-shy. I've got cash in the bank. I'm unwilling to invest it or to see it go anywhere. I'm not confident in my job. And I even heard in his call a lack of confidence in the way that the economy is being portrayed. He's not sure it's recovering or out of recession, even when he's being told that it is. Is that much nervousness justified by the facts of the economy right now?
I think that some degree of nervousness is justified. I don't quibble at all with the idea that we are in for some extended period of time, certainly months and perhaps years, before we can ever get back to something that resembles the late 90s. But I also think it's important to contrast what we have now with what we had in the early 80s and the mid-70s, which really were deep recessions, which with unemployment rates much higher than we have now. And in some ways, this is a good news, bad news thing. The good news is we're not there. The bad news is we have a weak economy without people getting nearly as down as they were in the 70s and 80s, and things could get a lot worse. I think one of my favorite surveys to look at is the University of Michigan's. And their consumer confidence number, which is sort of a difficult thing to understand, is reported every month. But when you dig down a little deeper, there's a question which they ask people, do you expect over the next 5 years continuous good times? And still this year, about half of people have said they can expect continuous good times over the next 5 years.
That's a lot of people, given all the news that's been out there.
And you compare it to 1975, when 8% of people answered yes to that question. So the good news is we're much better off than we were 20 or 25 years ago. The bad news is there are a lot of little things that could go wrong and make a lot more people feel like your caller Dennis. And then we would have a real big problem.
Does it really all still depend on this consumer confidence, which is another way of saying ultimately consumer spending? I mean, consumer confidence is such a funny combination of apprehension of facts, but also of just psychology that may have little to do with facts.
Yeah. If you set aside for a second, there's a technical debate within the economics profession about how much consumer confidence predicts consumer spending. But if we just set that aside and treat the second half of that equation, consumer spending, it does depend a great deal on that, because you can really think of the economy as being able to grow through three ways. One is people spending money. Two is companies spending money. And the third is the government spending money. People have continued to spend money throughout this entire recession. Their spending has slowed markedly, but it has not yet declined in any quarter, which is, I think, the first recession in which that's happened in about 55 years.
What's behind that? Is that partly to do with low interest rates? We've heard a lot about Detroit having zero financing on new automobiles. Have low interest rates somehow been an elixir for us here? Is there more in that bottle?
Low interest rates have played a big role. And just think about the last 20 years. I mean, I cited those statistics at the beginning about people expecting continuous good times. Mm-hmm. That's not simply people being silly. I mean, in the last 20 years, we've had inflation and interest rates go from double digits to below 3%. We've had the main political rival to the United States fall apart. We've had the main economic rival to the United States, Japan, fall into a decade-long slump. There are essentially, every time someone's taken a risk in this country financially, I'm overstating the case, in the last 20 years, it's been rewarded. If you invested in the stock market a decade ago, if you bought a house a decade ago, you're a lot richer for it. And there are a lot of people who've been left out of that. But for people who have done something like that, that's a big confidence booster.
So, but that's a historic kind of argument for confidence, even when things look glum.
I think that's right. I think the worry now is these things don't shift quickly. Mm-hmm. We don't have a terrorist attack or a recession, and then that causes suddenly people to say, this is scary, I'm reining in, I'm not going to spend money. It happens over a series of years, and if we have 2 or 3 years of weak growth, like I expect we'll have, and if we were to have some sort of political event, be it a drawn-out war in Iraq or something else, I think we could see people's confidence slip away, and then I think we see their spending slip away, and then we potentially get into the kind of situation that a lot of people were worried about after September 11th, but that did not come to fruition.
Christian Willer, I want to put this one point to you about the ongoing risk now of another terror attack. Lawrence Lindsay, the White House economic advisor, said today it's hard for – this was an argument for going to war and for a vigorous war on terror. He said it's hard for me to see how we have sustained economic growth in a world where terrorists with weapons of mass destruction are running around. If you weigh the cost of the war against the removal of a huge drag on global economic growth for foreseeable future in time, there's no comparison. Do we have a permanent drag now caused by the fear that at any moment, anywhere, we're told there could be a terrorist act and possibly a serious, significant one?
I think that's hard to predict. I mean, I think the immediate effect from September 11 were very temporary. On the contrary, we actually saw some increases in spending where we didn't really expect them, in particular in entertainment. People went out more. People went more to the movies. It made them more comfortable. There was also this, like, patriotic shopping spree that happened. I think there are other factors that weigh much more heavily on consumer confidence, in particular a slow economy that spills over into a very, very weak labor market and affects everybody. And let me also add to the consumer confidence argument here. The consumer can be as gung-ho about the economy as they want to be. The problem is the consumer actually has to have the money then to go out and shop, and that's, I think, where we've seen the most severe constraints, the most severe problems in the last few months. In particular, we've seen a rise in problem loans and default rates on consumer credits and on home mortgages. So lenders seem to be cutting back now, and they're easy money to consumers. And the other thing is income is just not growing as fast to really spur a lot of consumption growth.
People are losing jobs or not getting raises, you mean?
That is correct. And it, on the one hand, it affects the consumer confidence, but as David was just saying, there is still a lot of positive sentiment out there. But that has to be matched ultimately with the resources to go out and spend the money. And that's just not there.
Elizabeth is calling. Welcome, Elizabeth. You're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I'm calling with another report from the high-tech hinterlands.
Okay,
and,
how is it out there, Elizabeth?
Out here, there's a lot of unemployment. I was working for a little telecom here in my town and got laid off in the third layoff at my company in April.
And
my sister has been laid off since March. My ex-husband has been out of work for a year. He's a software developer. And I see a lot of people in the same position. And as consumers, we've all cut back because we have to. You know, we're rational beings operating in this market. We are not taking on debt that we have no reason to believe we are going to be able to repay. I wanted to buy a new car early in the year, and I'm darn glad I didn't take on a car payment. That wouldn't have been a good idea.
So do you feel some kind of warm wind headed back toward you, Elizabeth, some way out of this? Do you see light at the end of the tunnel?
I have a lot of experience in my field. I think I'll eventually be able to get a job, I hope, before winter. But I think it's going to be a long time coming. I think there really was a huge bubble in the high-tech sector in particular, and a lot of companies, I surmise, must have felt that they really had to upgrade all their employees' computers every year or two and all their software every year and had to have the latest telecom stuff and as much capacity as they could possibly imagine. And they were spending. And I think a disillusionment happened after Y2K didn't produce a crisis.
Right,
because I think a lot of work was done to prevent a crisis, which is what people don't realize. But also, September 11th burst that kind of fantasy bubble we were all living in, where it was just, ha ha ha, the old rules don't apply, we can all just glide along on this puffy cloud forever. I think that everybody just said, wait a minute, what's important?
What's important and what's real, I think, Elizabeth.
And what's real, that's right. And companies aren't throwing their money around any more than people are. And so in the high-tech sector in particular, I think it's really going to be a long time coming back, and I don't think it's going to have the same shape it had before.
Elizabeth, you raise a lot of good points. We hope you catch an updraft out there, and thank you for your call. David Leinhart, Jack Beatty raised earlier in the hour the notion that there may be a fundamental shift in the growth prospects for high-tech. Elizabeth is saying it's going to be a long time before we get back to something like even close to what we got accustomed to in the 90s. Is there something fundamental here that has human society learned that it doesn't need all that high tech, and so we've got a permanent kind of ding in the potential up curve on spending there?
I don't know if it's permanent, but I think it's going to take a long time. I think that we can think of all that spending, the Y2K spending, the bubble spending, as stealing growth from today and from next year. And I think companies bought so much equipment, many companies still have far more equipment than they can profitably use. I think it's going to take a long time. I think I mentioned before the three things that can make an economy grow are consumers, businesses, and the government. And one of the worrisome things right now is consumers, they're not going to get a lot better. The question is, do they stay where they are or get worse? And business still looks very weak, as it has been for the last 2 years.
And what about a successor to high tech then? Is there another engine? Is there another picture of what an economy, a robust economy in America, in the world, might look like, not driven by what we saw it driven by in the 90s?
First, I think it's important to remember that a good part of what happened in the 90s was simply our fooling ourselves. And so you assume that won't happen again in the next 5 years. So that even if something new came along, we're not going to invest at the ludicrous pace that we did, and we're not going to buy stocks the way we did in the 90s.
Well, in a way, we don't want to, but we do want to have a sense that something is coming along that's got a dynamo engine in the middle of it.
The closest thing there is to that is healthcare. Every month when the Labor Department reports how many jobs were lost or created, and right now we're always right around zero, it reports that the healthcare industry has about 25,000 new jobs. So over the last 2 years, while the country has lost, I think, about 2 million jobs, healthcare has gained a whole lot. And that's for obvious reasons. I mean, if you just think about it, we're getting older, medical technology is getting better, and in recent months, healthcare costs are going way up.
But Christian Weller, speaking to that point, is healthcare really, can it be the engine of economic growth if we're just taking care of our aches and pains and illnesses? Is that a true engine?
Well, it could be to some degree. It's not clear. And in terms of employment growth, as David was just mentioning, it can generate some, but, I mean, somebody has to pay for it. And I think that's where we'll hit the wall first. We've seen double-digit increases now for 2 years in terms of healthcare costs, and ultimately employers will shift that to the employees. And that means many employees will cut back on healthcare services. They will not be insured, or they will only take basic insurance. So there won't be that much money. I mean, ultimately, the spending increases will slow down, and that will ultimately have effects clearly on employment. So I don't think that that the healthcare industry necessarily will really replace what we saw in the high-tech industry.
And in the high-tech industry, Bill Joy, who's a computer scientist, sort of an industry visionary, he spoke recently about trillion-dollar markets when people connect to the Internet from their cars, or when computer chips are implanted in everything. And I wonder, is that the new frontier, the connecting? It doesn't somehow, at least the idea of connecting to the Internet from your car doesn't seem to me like a huge deal, but maybe computer chips going in everything. Maybe those are the next trillion-dollar market.
David Leinhart, what do you think about that?
Well, I don't know as much about technology as Bill Joy does, but I think it's a good question, because we could have very exciting new applications, and yet it doesn't necessarily mean that companies are going to be able to make profits in new ways. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have lots of new jobs. I think that's one of the things we learned from the dot-com bubble. We can have exciting changes, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to have some new company out there that's the next Microsoft.
That's a rough lesson. David Leinhart, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
David Leinhart covers economics for the New York Times. Jack Beatty, there's a picture of healthcare as our new engine, you know, ministering to one another. But it doesn't sound at all like a steel factory or even like a high-tech company in full bore.
No, it doesn't. And it has the sort of bifurcated labor market with, very few people on the top, doctors and hospital administrators doing very well, and then lots and lots and lots of service workers not doing so well. It's not like expanding manufacturing jobs where wages are higher.
We're talking tonight about economic recovery and maybe about recovery in the teeth of war. Are we coming out of the woods yet economically? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the U.S. economy, about economic recovery, and maybe about how war factors into that picture. Is your business, your company, your household getting back in gear economically? And what do you expect the next robust economy to look like? If it won't be 80s style or 90s style, what will it be? What's it going to take to get the U.S. back on track economically? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Christian Weller. He's an economist with the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And right now, Soya is on the line. Welcome, Soya, from Edinburgh, Pennsylvania. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking me.
Good to have you.
Hi, this is an international student here. I have two issues to point out. The first one is, as an international student here, when we came here like 2-3.5 years ago,
okay,
things were all right. We could work as much hours as we could.
We all remember. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's that. And now things are very limited on campus. People cannot work as much hours as they used to anymore. And we are taxpayers. Doesn't that affect the economy? And the second issue I want to point out is about the war with Iraq. If this nation goes to war with Iraq, what's going to happen? The price of oil is going to go up. inflation is going to go up, and people just can't keep up with the same lifestyle anymore. I'm saying this because just 2 months ago, my friend graduated, and he couldn't find a job here. He had to go home.
So where are you from?
I'm from Mali, West Africa.
And given that the economy is not as good now, are you hanging in the United States, or are you considering going home?
I won't. But the problem I'm trying to point out is we international students don't come here to spend thousands of dollars every year, and then once we're done, we have to go home and take those funny salaries. It's just not right.
So yeah, you're a voice of the world depending on this U.S. economy. Jack Beattie, you can hear loud and clear expectations that were there and that have not been met by one student from West Africa.
Yes, and having to give up the pot of gold here and go back to the relatively lower standard of living where he's from, that would be a blow. How are you going to keep him down on the farm after they've seen Paris? But you know, he did raise the issue there of the effect of these oil shocks on the U.S. economy. I mean, three different times over the last 20 years, we have had through wars and through other foreign policy moves. We have had serious oil shocks, which produced each of them recessions. The first in 1973, the Arab oil boycott of the United States for backing Israel in its war. That increased the price of gasoline within months by 33%. Mm-hmm. It sent both inflation and recession, stagflation, through the economy. The economy really didn't recover till the 80s. And on top of it, you had the Iran blip. That also, the Iranian Revolution, mm-hmm. in 1979, our siding with the Shah took the Iranian withdrawal of oil from the world market. That put us into a recession of 1980. And then the Gulf War. That resulted in a recession in 1990-91. So the pattern has been that U.S. military intervention or wars in the Middle East, to put it broadly, bring about recessions via inflation via the mechanism of suddenly higher oil prices.
Well, there's war and oil. Soya, I want to thank you for your call. And Christian Weller, let me put that to you. Lawrence Lindsay, again, the president's economic advisor, has said over the weekend and again today that war with Iraq could actually ease the oil problem by increasing supplies. You know, the Iraqi production has been constrained by UN limitations and by limited investment. Lindsay said, when there is a regime change in Iraq, you could add 3 million to 5 million barrels of production to world supply. The successful prosecution of the war would be good for the economy. Christian Weller, do you buy that?
Well, I mean, that makes a lot of assumptions. That means that the war is going to be over quickly, that there's going to be a stable regime, that stable regime is friendly to the U.S., that Saddam Hussein and his troops in their final retreat don't blow up all the oil wells. I mean, there is a lot of scenarios we can play out that this is very, very risky territory politically, and that spells over into very serious economic risks. I'm not very confident to make any predictions at this point, as Lawrence Lindsay is, that this will be an easy cakewalk, basically, to just oust Saddam Hussein, and all of a sudden we're going to have a democratic paradise on the Gulf. I don't think that's going to happen. I think the risks, the political and economic risks, are staggering the longer you think about it. I mean, there's the inflation risk. There's the risk that the war may drawn for a long time, requiring a massive military buildup both here and among the allies. Those are all serious economic consequences.
But what about the other risk, the risk of doing nothing and the specter of the potential for nuclear weapons hanging over the world's richest oil fields, of the risk of terror going on? Not that war in Iraq is going to solve that, but the Bush administration seems to be voting with its feet, saying we're going to address this through action rather than waiting. How does an economist look at that trade-off?
Well, I think that at this point, from an economic perspective, just being a visitor here, like looking from the outside in on the political debate, I don't think the case has been really made that doing nothing is a major risk at this point. I don't think that the administration really has made the case that sitting idly by will ultimately lead to this rise of a superpower in the Middle East. Mm. And on the other hand, I see enormous economic risks from going to war in Iraq. And I think we really have to consider those risks very seriously, given the precariousness of the U.S. economy, but also of the world economy.
Peter's calling from Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Yes, this is you know, it's not just conversation on this show, but on all the shows that I hear, it's very frustrating.
What exactly,
Brian,
Peter?
And I'll tell you why it's frustrating. Because there is no sign of recovery, and the surest sign is all we have to do is look at a chart of of the stock market, and you see it's going down. And it continues to go down. And when it does make a correction, it doesn't get up as high as it was before it goes down again and goes lower.
So you're still hurting from the stock market collapse, but at least do you take any solace in the fact that we've got only 1 or 2% output growth, but that growth?
No. And I tell you why no. All you do is look historically when the stock market bubbles like it does and then goes down like it's going down, and it's only at the beginning of it's going down, then what happens is you have a long period of down movement before recovery is not an up movement. Recovery is a sideways movement when things can kind of build up. And, you know, one of the bogus alibis that this downturn is the September 11th. Well, if you look at a stock chart, all right, Dow Jones, which I'm looking right now, a weekly chart, there was a 17-week decline, of which the last 2 weeks were the September 11th. And then it went up for maybe 15 weeks.
Peter, we hear you loud and clear, and thank you for your call. Christian Weller, here is the voice that sounds for all the world of the wounded and frustrated investor. How do you see the relationship between stock market and economy? Do we have to get back into a boom stock market to have a healthy economy?
No. That's a very simple answer. I think that...
But that's the equation we've become accustomed to. We had it for a decade.
I think a falsehood here. And let me just explain what I think. The stock market has become incredibly overvalued. It was a boom economy, a bubble economy, stock market to drew in a lot of people that were overinvested. A lot of wealth got destroyed in this downturn. The caller was right. I think it will continue for a while. This correction, and we'll probably will see some sideways movement. But I don't think that there is really a strong relationship from the stock market to the economy. There was somewhat of a movement as wealth was created. People had more money to spend, or they thought they had more money to spend. It fueled a consumption.
But what about the historical record that the caller refers to, saying whenever the stock market drops like a stone, so does the economy take a big hit?
Well, I think the economy drives the stock market and not the other way around. But you can have prolonged growth periods on the economy and not have major growth periods on the stock market. It has to do with income distribution. It has to do with wealth distribution. It has to do with simply what people's options are in terms of investing. They may not go for the stock market. They may feel safer in gold or in real estate or somewhere else.
Christian Weller, I regret to say it, but we're out of time tonight. I want to thank you so much for joining us and being on.
Thank you very much for having me, Tom.
Good to have you. Christian Weller is a macroeconomist at the Economic Policy Institute. Jack Beatty, this linkage between stock market luxury wealth and economic growth got pretty deeply forged in the 80s and 90s in the American mind.
Yeah, we had a word for it, the wealth effect. And, you know, people talk about New York real estate is actually going down, as if the wealth effect had, you know, is now got a sort of reverse effect. So people were spending that money or spending on the hope of it. Secretary O'Neill today in New England says we have a bumpy road to improvement ahead. That doesn't sound very bracing.
let's hope our shocks can handle it. Yeah. Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Okay.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, finding comfort in the Jewish High Holy Days. This is On Point. Today is Yom Kippur, the Jewish Day of Atonement. It's a final chance for appeal to demonstrate repentance and make amends for sins of the past year. Rabbi Deborah Hirsch is director of the Greater New York Council of Reformed Synagogues. In this radio diary, she reflects on how the Jewish High Holy Days have helped her through the past year and helped her to keep her faith in humanity.
When I sat here at the UAHC building and watched, as so many did, the commemoration memorial that took place down at Ground Zero, And I reflected back on where I was a year ago and had spent time working with Red Cross as a chaplain, spent time doing services, looking at the eyes of police officers or firefighters or individuals in congregations who were in horrific pain, struggling with the theme of the High Holy Days, one of which is that things are predetermined. And one of the liturgical pieces is a piece called the Unetane Tokef, which basically says that this is the day of judgment, and God judges who will live and who will die, who by fire, who by water, who by stoning, a very disturbing type of a litany. And last year, as I sat and I listened to it in the services, I struggled with it because I wanted to say, I can't buy this. This doesn't work for me. How can you talk about people being predetermined to die in such a horrific act of evil? One of my colleagues had written a piece on it, and the end of the prayer that is there talks about how by doing repentance, by doing acts of charity or doing what's right, righteousness, and prayer can avert the evil decree. And the way he read it was going through the rabbinic literature, where it's not necessarily the evil decree, but the evil of the decree. That's when evil happens and horrible things do happen. Not to allow the anger, not to allow the pain, the overwhelming sense of sadness to consume you, but to really, by turning oneself in a direction that still keeps you on the right track, by being able to still do acts of goodness in the world, prevents the evil from that evil to take over your life. So for a personal note, I think what it did clearly for me was to strengthen my sense of needing to do what we call tikkun, of continuing my desire to repair the world that has even been more fractured over the last year. Part of what terrorism does is to invoke a sense of uncertainty almost every day. When I looked at the Times picture of Grand Central and saw everybody just standing still at 8:46 a.m. and the thought crossed my mind, how wonderful, not only in terms of the observance, but then I'm sure there were people in Grand Central Station who were fearful, who were concerned, is another attack going to happen? And yet, whatever fear they might have felt, they were able to take that moment of silence and put that fear in a place that says this is a priority. And if people can live their lives more aware clearly than they were a year ago, but live their lives in a way that they still affirm life and still value moving on and take those pieces of their lives that have been blessings and try to enrich them, then I think we have entered into the future with a sense of hope, with a sense of human spirit and human integrity prevailing over that which can't surround us.
Rabbi Deborah Hirsch is director of the Greater New York Council of Reform Synagogues. Listeners, we'd like to hear from you. How are events in the news affecting you personally? If you have a story that would make a good radio diary, email us. The address is onpoint@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded